and welcome to this episode of the Maryland Risk Management Education Podcast. My name is Paul Geringer, and I am the Extension Legal Specialist here in the Department of Ag and Resource Economics at the University of Maryland. And today we have our traditional end of the year episode with Tiffany Lashmet from Texas A&M, my counterpart there. And we will do our review of what some of the top legal issues we have worked on over the past year have been. So I will turn it over to Tiffany and myself. Hey, Tiffany, welcome back.
Paul, thanks for having me.
Yep, it's what we do every year, isn't it?
That's right. Christmas tradition.
It's how we know the year is coming to an end.
Exactly.
So should we go ahead and get started on our list? And then
sounds good to
people
me.
People can question us if we're actually right on what the top legal issues are.
Perfect.
So how about you kick us off with what I believe might be your favorite topic, and then I believe you have a very long law review article in the process of getting published related to waters of the U.S. and how have we changed with the movement towards the Biden administration?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Paul, if you listen back to any of our old episodes, this is one of those that's like never going away. Apparently, we've had waters of the United States as a topic for at least the last 5 or 6 years. And of course, it's still on our list for 2021.
And I give it to my students every year as a possible paper topic. And before this podcast, we recorded this podcast, I just got done reading yet again another article on waters of the U.S. in the Clean Water Act.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's the gift that keeps on giving. So just quick background, the Clean Water Act, right, is a federal statute that was passed in 1970. And it essentially says that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the EPA have federal jurisdiction over waters of the United States. Where this comes into play for agriculture is if you want to discharge a pollutant into a water of the United States, you've got to get a permit from the EPA. If you want to do what's called dredge and fill, which essentially is like moving any dirt on a water of the United States, you've got to get a permit from the Corps of Engineers. The question is, what is a water of the United States, as that term is used in the Clean Water Act? And we didn't know because Congress didn't write that in. They used the phrase and then they didn't define it. So we spent the last, 40 years arguing back and forth about that. Lots of cases at the United States Supreme Court. Kind of the most famous is a 2006 case called Rapanos. And in that case, there ended up being what we call a plurality opinion. So essentially, it ended up being 4-1-4 is how the justices voted. Justice Scalia basically issued an opinion saying he thinks the water of the United States has to be a relatively permanent body of water. Justice Kennedy was the one there, and he said that he thought the right test is whether there was a significant nexus between the waters. And so that's important here in a minute when we look at the new Biden definition. So in 2015, the Obama administration passed what they called the WOTUS rule. And I think that if you look at that language, it kind of expanded the scope of waters of the United States, maybe beyond what the case law had done. We had lawsuits filed galore all over the country. There were various stays and it was kind of a mess. Then in 2020, the Trump administration passed its rule that it called the Navigable Waters Protection Rule. As compared to the Obama regulation, it narrowed the scope of what was included in the definition of waters of the U.S. Again, we had lawsuits galore. Some of those are still pending. A couple have found that rule to be invalid. But then just last month, the Biden administration passed its proposed rule. And essentially, the way the administration described it is they're going back to the pre-2015 approach and sort of trying to codify the approach in Rapanos. And they're doing that by including waters that are relatively permanent, like Justice Scalia alluded to, and waters where there's a significant nexus, like Justice Kennedy had in his opinion. And so right now, that's a proposed rule. There's a 60-day comment period. Once they take comments and consider those, then the Biden administration will pass their final rule. And the only thing I am certain of with that is that there will be lawsuits galore after that passes.
I'm pretty sure lawyers just get rich off WOTUS. That's all it is, isn't it?
Well, Jim Bradbury has said that he thinks that's what WOTUS means in French before. So Yeah. And on that front, if you are interested in this topic and you want to get into some more detail, if you want to read more than anyone wants to know, Jesse Richardson and I are publishing a law review article. Paul, that's what you mentioned. Next year, it'll be out, kind of really going through a historical look at these definitions and the cases. I've also got a podcast coming out in January where Jim and I are going to walk through the Biden rule and kind of get into the nitty gritty there. So if people want more information, that'll be available.
Yeah. And I'm glad, Tiffany, that you like to keep up with POTUS, because normally in my class, I assign the students to read yours, Jim's, and Jesse's stuff. Excellent. On the Clean Water Act and POTUS.
Happy to help. Happy to help. Paul, let's turn and look at another topic that I think if you like counted up topics that are mentioned in agricultural news publications for 2021, this has to be the most mentioned, and that's carbon contracts. What's going on there?
Yeah, so we've seen an uptick in because of proposed changes in the movement with the Biden administration to sort of taking into effect greenhouse gases and sort of some of the offsets that may be available. Companies looking at how do we take into account carbon contracts, and we have a whole lot of farmland and forested land out there that could probably be potentially taken advantage of for this. But it seems like right now, we're hearing a lot about it, but we don't have a lot of details. Or am I looking at this wrong?
No, I think that's right. I mean, right now, what we're seeing is almost all voluntary programs. I think there's an exception in California with some cap and trade there, but essentially it's voluntary programs where if you're a landowner and you want to sign up with a company, you can do that. Talk to us, Paul, about those contracts. What are some things people need to be aware of? I realize we could do this for an hour, but give us some of the
highlights. I think the biggest thing on this is you really do have to pay attention to what you're doing it. And I think we've all talked about this at meetings and stuff. These are very hard contracts for us to even look at.
Yeah.
Like there aren't very many of them publicly available. They're not publicly available on companies' websites. So you really do need to take time to think about it. Figure out, A, how long is this thing going to last on your property? What's the market price that they're saying carbon's worth in it? And then what are the fees that are going to be taken out? So is it going to be a percent, you know, based off what potential loss is, and then covering the overhead for either the data manager or the aggregator to kind of take this upon? And each one presents different issues depending on how you do it with carbon. But the biggest one is just read the thing, look at it, take into account what it's going to limit you to do on the property.
Yeah.
In a lot of these cases, the goal is going to be to keep carbon in the ground. So this is going to mean tillage is going to have to be almost no-till or minimum till, depending on what the contract allows. I think right now, those are the biggest things. It's just monitor the contract, look at the practices, see how much you're going to get paid, and understand that part and what the fees that are going to be taken out is going to be and how much you're actually going to get paid. Because on a lot of these, the market rate may be anywhere from $10 to $20 from what I've seen. But, you know, there's going to be fees taken out and the landowner is going to get substantially less. And if it's leased, you're going to have to get the landowner involved to make sure that they're willing to continue that on, even if you are no longer farming the property, because these could be long-term contracts that need to be maintained. And if not, there may be penalties for paybacks or other things that could come into play looking at them. I think those are the biggest things looking at them. I think there are other things that need to be taken into consideration, and probably maybe not so much in Texas, but here in Maryland, things we need to take into account is how do we, you know, the fact we have a history of no-till here, a long history of it, how do we take that into account in some of these contracts? How are we going to make sure that it's equitable for all producers to get involved in? It's been a fun area to sort of start looking at and figuring out how the market's going to develop. But
yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it's something we're both working on resources for, right, for 2021. I mean, I've got a podcast episode that's already out, and we'll link to that I think is pretty helpful. But Paul, I know you're working on various presentations and checklists and things like that as well.
Yeah, I've got a couple of presentations scheduled for next year where apparently people just want to hear about this topic and I needed to learn about it. I've actually got one later this week. on it, and then early next year. But I think, yeah, checklist, and then hopefully going to do some more research on it over the summer, because it seems to be a developing area that we kind of need to take into account, and the land grant system needs more information on it.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, so let's move on to our next topic, and we'll stay far west with this. And Tiffany, what can you tell us about Proposition 12 in California?
Yeah, this is another one of those sort of hot topics, and we're pretty timely on this, as a part of this law is set to go into effect on January 1st. But essentially, back in 2018, California voters passed a ballot initiative that established some specific spacing requirements for veal breeding pigs and laying hens. So specific square feet requirements for how much room they have to have. For laying hens, they have to be in cage-free systems, et cetera. And then the second piece of that, which I think gets more interesting, is they also banned the sale of veal, pork, and eggs in California if they have not been raised in conformity with these laws. So in other words, California says, if you're going to raise these types of animals in our state, here's the rules you have to follow. And then if you want to sell your products in our state, regardless of where you raise them, they have to be raised in conformity with the laws. And that was a real problem, because the statistics show that very few, at least on the pork and egg side, very few farms in the United States would have met those requirements. And it was really expensive to make changes to the barns and the physical operations to meet those. And so it's one of those things that will have a major impact on producers, not just in California, but across the country, right? If they want to sell into a major market, which is California. So as you can imagine, no one's surprised, there've been a lot of legal challenges to this. None of them have been successful. There were some egg industry lawsuits filed early. There were some lawsuits filed by states attorneys general early that were dismissed. The most recent was a lawsuit filed by the National Pork Producers Council and the American Farm Bureau. Those were both dismissed in the lower court. There's currently a petition for certiorari on that still pending at the United States Supreme Court. I checked it, at least as of this morning, nothing had been done on that petition. So that's something, like I say, the at least portions of that, in particular, the cage-free eggs and the pork requirements go into effect on January 1. So can have major impacts, I think, on potentially producers nationwide. And again, that's a topic I've done a podcast on. If anybody wants to listen to that and wants more detail, I've got that available as well.
Yeah, because and that's a very good podcast episode with, I think, Beth from the National Egg Law Center.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah, and memory serves me correctly, a lot of this, and this is mainly for legal nerds, is all based around Commerce Clause issues too, is it? Which is,
yeah, it's funny, right? Because like, if you think about those dormant Commerce Clause cases we read in law school, they're from like the 30s. And so the fact that we're kind of having this happen now in ag, no less, is really interesting. And just, I mean, it is interesting to think about, right? Like California passed this law and the law itself doesn't extend past California, right? But the impacts of being able to sell in California do affect people other places. Does that violate the Dormant Commerce Clause or not? Lower courts have said no. So I think it's interesting.
And the Californians want bacon.
That's exactly right.
We got to figure out how to get them bacon.
And I don't remember the exact number. It's upwards of 90%, though, of the pork consumed in California gets imported. So, yeah, it's a real issue.
Yeah, that would be.
Okay. Well, sticking with the livestock industry, Paul, the next topic on our list comes from Montana, and that's the litigation surrounding the beef checkoff. Talk to us about what that is and what's going on.
Yeah. So another thing that just keeps on going and going and going seems to be always be challenges to the beef checkoff program, specifically related to the state of Montana at times. But within it, there's been a challenge by RCAF, an advocacy group there, to look at the fact that the beef checkoff exists and the marketing programs that come out of it are compelled speech, which is a violation of the First Amendment. So we're getting back into constitutional law. Right now, we have a Ninth Circuit opinion from earlier this year looking at that. And, you know, the Ninth Circuit looked at it and said it's not compelled speech. USDA is highly involved in this process throughout. So the way the beef checkoff program works is USDA through the Ag Marketing Service enters into these MOUs with qualified state beef councils. And these qualified state beef councils through this MOU develop this marketing program, research, and a whole host of other things, utilizing their portion of the checkoff dollars. And then another portion of checkoff goes back to nationals, and parts of it go to other states that may not have as many cattle to help them as well. But within this, because USDA is heavily involved in this process, everything that goes through these qualified beef councils is approved by USDA in some point. So if a qualified beef council develops a marketing plan, USDA approves it. Mm-hmm. If they enter into a third-party contract for somebody to do work for them and to develop materials for them, USDA has to approve that. They approve their budget. So because of that, the agency's heavily involved in this. And this is not compelled speech at this point, but this is speech we would expect the government to do in its normal sense of doing its job. So it's we really don't have control over the speech. The government does. You know, if we think about it with our tax dollars, once that goes into place, that's not a violation of the First Amendment. So this is kind of following that same principle that because the government's heavily involved in it, it's not compelled speech. We're not forcing these beef ranchers to say stuff that they wouldn't want to. We're having the government do it. So it's not compelled speech. There's also a challenge that's ongoing in the D.C. Circuit with related to this that RCAS brought, saying that USDA did not follow the proper process to even enter into these MOUs with these state beef councils. So that the idea is they didn't follow the Administrative Procedures Act correctly to even put these MOUs into place. And that's something we're going to have to follow and potentially would be something we could talk about next year.
Yeah. Well, and it's one of those things. This was a session at the American Ag Law Association conference, Paul, and I don't know if you were in that session, but I thought that they did a really good job too of explaining that, you know, the potential impacts of something like this are beyond just the beef industry, because there are a number of different commodity checkoffs. So it's something for folks to be aware of, and they're all a little different, but it's something to definitely be aware of as we see these lawsuits proceed.
Yeah, because if you look at it, I can't remember if I was in that session or not, or I heard something related to that session, but you think about it, the corn, soybeans, a lot of all of the checkoff programs could potentially be implicated in this and create whole host of problems.
Yeah, it is funny too. I mean, that's kind of two in a row here, Paul, that we are talking about constitutional law. And I guess whenever I was in law school, it didn't strike me that constitutional law would be that relevant to an ag law practice, but it sure is, at least on this year's summary.
So do we want to move on to more Supreme Court rulings in your favorite area of water law and what's been going on there?
Yeah, this is another one of those places where I feel like I draw the short end of the stick because I write about this stuff and Paul's like, okay, Tiffany will take those.
Touch water law.
I know. A couple of really interesting cases this year out of the United States Supreme Court related to water law. Interestingly, both of these we're going to talk about are unanimous opinions. And so if there's one thing, I guess, that can bring the country together, it's water law, because all nine justices agreed on both cases. The most recent came out just in the last week or so, and that's a groundwater law case, Mississippi versus Tennessee. And in that case, there is a lawsuit filed that's dealing with the water in the Middle Claiborne Aquifer. And if you think a little bit about like the map, you know, Memphis sits kind of in the corner of Tennessee, and that aquifer sits under the city of Memphis, but it also is spread out and it sits under eight other states as well, including Mississippi. And so Mississippi filed a lawsuit against Tennessee, Memphis, and the Memphis Water Utility, basically claiming that Tennessee's pumping so much water that it's resulted in the loss of billions of gallons of water that used to be underneath Mississippi. So essentially right there saying Tennessee is pumping and taking their water from beneath Mississippi. Now, this is real technical, but it's going to matter in a minute. Mississippi expressly said they were not seeking equitable apportionment. equitable apportionment is a doctrine in the law that had only been applied to surface water. And it's basically, if you've got interstate surface water, one of the parties can seek for the court to kind of equitably apportion that water, right? Tell each one how much they can use and set the rules for that. Mississippi wasn't seeking that here. They were clear about that. So we get a unanimous decision written by Chief Justice Roberts. And what the court held, the first thing they looked at was, does equitable apportionment apply? Because at least in these surface water cases, the sole remedy in that scenario is equitable apportionment. You can't seek another remedy. And here, what the court held for the first time was that equitable apportionment does apply to an interstate aquifer if it's a multi-state aquifer, water flows naturally between the states, and the actions of one state affects the portion of water beneath another state. So kind of three-part test here, but equitable apportionment will apply, right? And so essentially, since that's the remedy, that's what the claim Mississippi would have to bring. But since they didn't, and they didn't try to amend their complaint to do so, the court dismissed the case. So I think going forward, this can have real impacts. One of them is right now we know this can apply to interstate aquifers, but it may be really hard to win, because to win an equitable apportionment case, you have to show substantial injury or damage by clear and convincing evidence. That's tough to do in the groundwater context, right? From a causation standpoint, that's hard to prove. Substantial injury can be hard to prove. So we'll see how that plays out. I've read some articles where lawyers have said they think maybe this ruling will actually lead to some groundwater compacts. But you know how we have sometimes like surface water compacts, like Texas and New Mexico have one on the Rio Grande, for example. Maybe we'll see some compacts there, because if the parties have a compact that governs instead of equitable apportionment, that might be true. But frankly, those compacts keep seeming to land people in court too. So I'm not sure that it's going to change that. But that was the first case. The second one, also from the South, is Florida versus Georgia. And that's a lawsuit that has to do with the Apalachicola-Chattahoochee-Flint River Basin. And if you don't think I think of Alan Jackson every time I say that, you're wrong, Paul.
I figured you would.
Yeah, yeah. So in that case, Georgia basically says that Florida has taken more than their fair share of the water from that basin, right? Florida's, I said that backwards. Let me say that again. So in that lawsuit, Florida claims that Georgia is taking more than their fair share of water in that lawsuit. Because this is an equitable apportionment case, like we just talked about before, Florida's got to prove substantial injury by clear and convincing evidence. Okay, and so the real question here is, can Florida prove that it's Georgia's actions that have caused their substantial damage? So it's a causation issue. And we end up with a unanimous opinion by Justice Barrett dismissing the case. And essentially what the court found is that Florida just couldn't prove the causation of damages. I mean, yeah, you can tell us that your oyster industry is in peril, but you can't prove that it was something Florida did to cause that. Like, here's 12 other potential causes, right? And they talk about the ecosystem of the river, but there were a lot of questions about how measurements were taken and what other effects there might have been, right? Drought and different actions taken by people along the river. And so the court just dismissed the case. And like I say, I think that ties in a little bit to that Mississippi case and this idea that it's hard to prove by clear and convincing evidence causation of substantial damage. So going forward, we'll see. I mean, there are a lot of interstate water lawsuits filed, and I expect to see more in the future. So it's certainly an area of law that I think we're just going to see become more prevalent.
I think you're right on that one.
Okay, Paul, this is one. I think our last topic here is actually interesting because it's not a change that has happened. But I don't know about you. I've gotten a ton of program requests and requests for blogs and podcasts talking about the potential changes we hear about in the news. Yep. On estate and capital gains taxes.
Yeah, because if there's one thing that will get people in the ag community to start thinking about estate planning and maybe actually do it, it's someone in Congress talking about the potential of changing estate and capital gains taxes.
Yeah. So just basically, I'll sort of give just a really quick kind of what we're looking at. And then Paul, I'd like to hear what advice you're giving to people, and we'll see if it matches up with mine. But on the estate tax, really what we've seen is the potential of them lowering the limit on the lifetime exemption. And currently it's what, 11.4 million per person?
It's 11.4 and it will be 12.06 next year.
Okay. So $11 to $12 million exemption, you know, there was some buzz about maybe they would take it back to 5 million. There were some bills that talked about 3.5 million. And, you know, it's one of those things when you're a farm or ranch operation, it doesn't take a lot to get to that 3.5 million. And so I think there's been some concern there. And then with capital gains taxes, there's sort of been two different things that have been floated around. The first one's doing away with the stepped up basis, which, right, I think that's a really important issue for farm and ranch families who've got intergenerational land transfers.
Yes.
Right.
And that one could have huge impacts.
Yeah. And essentially, right, if you inherit land, you get to step up the value of that land for capital gains tax purposes to when you inherited it, not when it was purchased.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, whatever it is on the day you inherit it, that's your new basis in the property.
Yeah. And that huge deal, right, when you think about the amount of increase in the value of land. Mm-hmm. And the other thing they floated at one point, at least one bill did, was taxing unrealized gains at death. And that, I think that's, I mean, a big concern for a lot of, again, farm and ranch families. But what that basically says is if you've got assets that have increased in value over your lifetime, at death, you would have to pay a tax on those, a capital gains tax, even though you hadn't sold them. And right now the rule is you only pay that tax if the property is sold. So certainly I see why people were concerned. To this point, nothing has happened. That none of these have been changed or passed. So, Paul, what are you telling folks they should do on this front?
Well, the first thing I tell them to do is to step back and just look and go, we've never actually lowered capital, or we've never lowered the estate tax at any point in our history.
Oh.
It's always continued to at least go up for the most part.
Okay.
And the other thing I can point out to people is you have to think about who all has to vote on this to get it done. And you have to realize that probably Joe Manchin and Sinema may not vote for this. So then I go, if it is that case, and it does pass, there's always that possibility. You really do need to go in and initially get stuff set up to sort of prevent some of this from coming in. And there are ways to do this. And one of the bigger things that's been a part of this too is the trust issue that we may look back at trust every, what is it, 15 years?
I think that's
right. And tax trust, but there would be a look back period and we would tax trust based on gains. So, okay, we may not be able to use trust, but what are the other tools in our toolbox that we could use as estate planning people to do this? So is it looking at a business entity? How do we set that up in a way to, you know, minimize some of these impacts? As I tell them, as I tell a lot of producers, if there are these changes, the biggest thing that's going to happen is it's going to be like Lotus. And what Bradbury says about what Lotus means in French, whatever these changes are, means that lawyers and accountants are going to make a lot of money because people are going to have to come in and get stuff set up.
Yeah.
So the biggest thing I tell people is think about how you want it set up and then work with someone to do what it is now. And then whatever changes need to be made, we can easily make when the changes, if the changes ever do come to fruition.
You know, mine is similar, right? The first thing I say is you need to have an estate plan now. And you need to have a relationship established with your lawyer and your accountant because there could be lines around the block if some of this stuff passes, right? So I think that's important. And then, yeah, same as you. I've told people multiple times, people are kind of like, oh my gosh, we got to change X, Y, Z because of this bill. I'm not changing anything until something passes, because what if you make a change that then bites you when the final version of that bill has changed seven times before it gets passed, right?
Yeah, you don't want to do that. You want to wait till it's passed and then figure out what the rules are and not what the potential rules are. You never play the game based on the potential rules. You play the game on the rules.
That's exactly right. Yep. Cool. Well, that's our list. We'd love to hear if other people have ideas of things we could have included.
Include a tax issue, so that should make some people happy out there that believe ag law is driven by tax law.
That's right. Even though we are far, far from tax experts.
No, we're not tax experts in any way. We have to ask other people tax questions, don't we, Tiffany?
That's what. Listen, Christine Chitgren's on my speed dial for that exact reason.
I was going to say, Christine, Pat, a few other people are on my list that I just emailed them, like, explain this to me, or go to their websites and look for if they put anything out. So Tiffany, what do you have in the works for 2021?
2022.
Or 2022, pardon me. I'm a year
behind. I think I've got some cool stuff that is going to be coming up in 2022. One thing, Justin Benavides and I are working on a direct beef sales handbook. So looking at the legal and economic issues of direct beef sales, I think that's going to be a cool project to work on. And we're going to do some programs around that, webinar, et cetera. And then I'm going to crank out some law review articles, Paul, which, you know, is not my favorite assignment, but I've got a couple of great research associates who have gotten me some great data collected. So I'm going to write on the Farm Animal Liability Act, kind of a 50-state survey of those statutes. And then I think I'm going to do some stuff on pesticide drift for a second article. So, and what about you? What's your plan for the next year?
Hide and just try to work all year and get stuff done. But now the main thing is I've got two ongoing projects, one related to hemp and developing risk management tools for hemp. Mm-hmm. So we're in the process of right now trying to, we pulled together some county regulations in California, and we're looking at other states that may have similar regulations limiting how hemp is produced, to try to then figure out, okay, how do we, you know, at least provide some resources to potential growers if this is a concern in their area, of how do you prevent some of the nuisance issues from developing? And then how do you develop contract issues, which I know you and Justin have also done some work and have a online course on this, but we're working on trying to put together some sample contracts and a handbook related to some of these issues, so growers can better understand how to get involved in this potential market that may have some opportunities for them depending on where they're at. Then our other one is working with Oklahoma State and Cornell University related to solar. And myself and Shannon Farrell, along with a great legal researcher, are working on putting together some resources for landowners to better understand the contracts that they're presented with. And then out of that, we'll probably already talking about how to develop a law review article focusing in on the bigger issues, and then, you know, just a lot of estate planning workshops as well, and working on carbon contracts. And that's the main stuff that's focused in on my life. Oh yes, and I should not forget, also working in on farm stress and some of the topics related to stress and bankruptcy. And then in Maryland, there's a lot more legal requirements than there are in the state of Texas. So that creates additional stress for producers. So trying to provide producers with resources to help in that situation as well. So that's a lot of what I have ongoing for the next year. And I'm sure there'll be something else that will come up, because I'm sure the courts or Congress or the General Assembly will create more problems for us all.
Well, one thing, Paul, I'll mention too, you and I will both be at the American Ag Law Association conference next year. So
yes,
if you are an ag lawyer or a law student, you should come join us in New Orleans, November 10th through 12th. So get it on your calendar. It is always a blast. We love AALA.
Yes, it will be a fun time in New Orleans. We will learn a lot. And the hotel is in a nice area near the French Quarter.
Awesome. So
it'll be a very quiet area compared to other areas you can be at in New Orleans.
Right. Great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Paul, let's do this again next year.
Let's do it again next year. Sounds like fun.
All right.
I wouldn't know it's Christmas without doing this.
Exactly. All right. Well, happy holidays.
Happy holidays, and have a good new year.
Thank you for listening to this episode. I put, like I always do, the Tiffany's contact info and some links to some of the stuff we talked about today in the show notes. So if you want to get in touch with one of us, you can just click down there. Thank you for listening. We'll be back in the new year with new episodes. But until then, have a safe holiday season and a happy new year.